Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Prison Admittance and Strip Searches Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 2, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Florence v. Board of Chosen Freeholders. The question in this case was whether the Fourth Amendment permits the government to conduct a visual strip search of any person who is admitted to jail, even when there's no reasonable basis for suspecting that the person had weapons or contraband. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the government may conduct a visual strip search of any person who is admitted to the general population of a jail. The Chief Justice, as well as Justices Scalia and Alito, joined Justice Kennedy's opinion in full. Justice Thomas joined that opinion as to all except Part 4. The Chief Justice and Justice Alito also wrote separate concurring opinions. Justice Breyer filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. To discuss the case, we have Sarah Hart, who is a prosecutor in Philadelphia. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Hart.
I am Sarah Hart, a prosecutor in Philadelphia. I have previously served as the chief counsel for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and the director of the National Institute of Justice. I'm very grateful to the Federalist Society for inviting me to analyze a significant corrections case just decided by the United States Supreme Court. Florence versus the Burlington County Freeholders is a prison strip search case. This week, on April 2nd, the Supreme Court issued a decision on searches admitted to short-term detention facilities and whether strip searches should be limited based on the underlying reason for detention. Just to be clear, strip searches involve a close visual inspection of all body cavities, but no physical touching. This is a 5-4 decision, with Justice Kennedy writing for the majority and upholding the strip search. Here's the background. Florence had previously been arrested in 1998 for driving a car he didn't own and fleeing police officers. He was initially charged with aggravated assault and other offenses for this incident, but pled guilty to the lesser charge of hindering prosecution and obstructing the administration of law. He was fined for these offenses, and when he failed to make timely installment payments, a warrant was issued for his arrest. He then paid the full fine. For some unknown reason, the arrest warrant remained in the criminal warrant database. In 2005, a New Jersey state trooper stopped a car, and the record check showed the outstanding warrant. Florence told the trooper that the warrant was invalid and produced paperwork showing he had paid the fine in full. Nevertheless, the trooper arrested Florence and took him to the Burlington County Jail for detention. As part of the standard Burlington County intake process, corrections officers conducted a visual examination of Florence for contraband, gang tattoos, injuries, or evidence of disease. There is a factual dispute as to whether the Burlington County Jail did more. Florence contended that they required a visual body cavity inspection that consisted of opening his mouth, lifting his tongue, and lifting his genitals. All agree that the officer sat an arm's length away and did not touch Florence. After being housed in the general population in Burlington County Jail for 6 days, Florence was moved to Essex County Jail. The Essex jail policy required a visual body cavity inspections of all incoming detainees. Florence claimed that he was required to remove his clothing and shower in front of the officers. He also claimed he was required to open his mouth, lift his arms, turn around so he was facing away from the officers, lift his genitals, squat, and cough. Essex disputes this, asserting there was no visual body cavity inspection. The next day, Florence was released. Florence filed a civil rights suit, including a Fourth Amendment challenge to the requirement that he remove his clothes in front of the officers and expose body cavities as part of the intake process. Florence argued that such searches cannot be conducted on detainees arrested for non-indictable offenses, that means offenses with a penalty of 6 months or less imprisonment, absent reasonable suspicion. The district court certified a class action and granted summary judgment for the plaintiffs, holding that blanket strip search policies were unconstitutional and only could be performed with reasonable suspicion of drugs, weapons, or other contraband. The district court certified the issue for interlocutory review, and the Third Circuit reversed, holding that the searches alleged here were less intrusive than the searches in Bell versus Wolfish. While recognizing the significant intrusions of visual body cavity searches, the Third Circuit majority noted that detention facilities face significant security concerns. It rejected the argument that the reason for the detention required different levels of searches. The United States Supreme Court granted cert to resolve a split among the circuit courts. The arguments broke down as follows. Florence, represented by Jeffrey Fisher, argued that blanket strip search policy is unconstitutional and an individualized reasonable suspicion analysis is required. He argued that corrections officers should consider factors such as the seriousness of the current and prior offense, whether the circumstances of the arrest indicate that the detainee was purposely trying to gain admission to the prison, whether the preliminary searches revealed weapons, drugs, or other contraband. He argued that blanket rules for all detainees would require intrusive searches for a tremendous number of citizens detained for trivial offenses. Both Burlington County and Essex County filed briefs in opposition. The United States filed an amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to uphold the Third Circuit opinion. Numerous amicus briefs were filed on both sides, 10 supporting Florence and 11 supporting the counties. The oral argument showed that the majority simply wasn't going to buy Florence's arguments. Counsel for Florence essentially conceded that the removal of clothing, application of medicine, and observations during showers were permissible. He argued, though, that courts should employ a physical distance standard that would preclude close visual observations. The court, however, didn't seem to think that constitutional questions should focus on whether the corrections officer was 10 feet, 5 feet, or 2 feet away from the detainee. During argument, Justice Kennedy had a very pragmatic concern. He inquired about the practical implication of a case-by-case reasonable suspicion test, wondering whether such a test would lead to frequent legal claims that corrections officers subjectively use some impermissible factor in determining whether to conduct higher-level searches. He also seemed unimpressed with the argument that a number of jurisdictions already had reasonable suspicion policies. Nicole Saharsky provided an excellent argument in support of the Third Circuit opinion. Essentially representing the Bureau of Prisons' perspective, she focused on the practical problems of implementing search policies using a major crime, minor crime distinction. She also focused on the need to ensure full searches before any prisoner is placed in the general population, the limited information available to correctional staff during the intake process, and effectively challenged the notion that minor offenders can be presumed to be low risks. She also argued for the need for clear and easily implementable search rules. On Monday, April 2nd, the court issued a 5-4 decision upholding the search. Here's how the opinions broke down. Justice Kennedy authored the main opinion, which held that any pretrial detainee about to be admitted to the general jail population can be required to undress, lift and manipulate parts of his or her body to show that there's nothing hidden, and be subject to close visual inspection of body cavities. This opinion was supported in its entirety by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia and Alito. Justice Thomas noted that he did not join Part 4 of this opinion. The Chief Justice and Justice Alito wrote separate opinions emphasizing the limited nature of the ruling, noting that it does not address whether such strip searches would be permissible for prisoners that will not be held with other prisoners. Although Justice Thomas did not explain his reasons for not joining the entire opinion, given his past positions in prison cases, it would be reasonable to conclude that he did not see the need to make jail search procedures dependent on the prisoner's future housing assignment. Justice Breyer authored the dissenting opinion for the remaining justices. He argued that the Fourth Amendment prohibits strip searches of individuals arrested for minor crimes that do not involve drugs or violence, or if there is no reasonable basis for the corrections officer to conclude that the specific detainee poses a risk of carrying drugs, weapons, or other contraband. So what does this all mean? The majority opinion is remarkable for a number of reasons. First, it's very clear that the court found the positions of Nicole Saharsky very persuasive. Justice Kennedy went to great lengths to make the case that jails face difficult problems with gangs, violence, weapons, drugs, and other smuggled contraband. He concluded that the new arrest leading to the jail detention is not necessarily indicative of the risk posed by that detainee. He recited the past history of Florence, who was originally charged with more serious offenses. He also cited numerous specific examples, like Timothy McVeigh, of dangerous individuals who were initially detained on minor charges. Justice Kennedy also noted that corrections officers often lack complete information to make reliable assessments about the dangerousness of specific detainees. But the one issue that appears to have driven this decision is the need for a clear, bright-line rule for corrections officers to follow. Justice Kennedy specifically rejected the proposed reasonable suspicion standard as unworkable. In my view, the majority understood that complex, individualized assessments are difficult in high-volume detention facilities, and if required, they would inevitably lead to a lot of litigation. The court has in the past recognized that prisoners are a litigious group. I suspect that Justice Kennedy did not want to see the federal courts mired in fact-intensive litigation over specific strip search decisions. So what is the practical impact of this decision? First, in recent years, local governments have paid out over $36 million to settle strip search class actions involving low-level offenders. This decision will basically shut down that lucrative litigation for prisoners' rights lawyers. Second, many prisons and jails have already adopted some of the individualized search rules proposed by the plaintiffs. Given how labor-intensive some of those assessments can be, I suspect that some, but not all, detention facilities will start moving toward the more bright-line search rules now upheld in Florence. Still, there are some unanswered questions that will be undoubtedly litigated in the future. Most large detention facilities keep newly admitted prisoners quarantined for medical clearances for the first few days. I expect some challenges will be raised about the strip searches of detainees who will be quarantined before admission to the general population. Finally, I have one parting observation for any lawyers like me who have authored amicus briefs for the Supreme Court. Often one questions whether those briefs are really worth the effort, since they often don't appear to make any difference whatsoever. Well, Florence is a case where the amicus briefs really helped shape the court's opinion. Justice Kennedy cites extensively from the amicus briefs to discuss the practical problems faced by jail officials. In these kind of important public policy debates, the court can be counted on to understand the fine points of court precedent. But it is the amicus briefs that can genuinely enlighten the court on the real-life implications of its decisions. And that makes it all worthwhile. This is Sarah Hart. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.